Let me bring you up to date on the project of raising ducks. Ducklings grow fast and are no longer fuzzy, cute creatures that fit in your hand. As they grow, they make stories to tell, sometimes faster than I can write them down. So I put several weeks together here so that you will know in broad terms all that has happened. Ducklings are not like oak trees. Like I said, they grow fast. These cute, fuzzy, web-footed friends become in just weeks gawky birds with odd, stringy feathers sticking out. It seems strange that as young animals go, ducklings would be the ones that need to be kept dry, but they don't start out shedding water. That's still a couple of weeks away. They're neither cute nor beautiful. They have both bits of fluff of babyhood and feathers that are, as of now, mostly stalk and little down. They're not graceful. I imagine this is like seeing the inside of a cocoon and watching the thing that is neither a perfect caterpillar nor yet a monarch, orange and black, carried on the wind. These ducklings are not yet fully what they will become. The birds don't seem to mind their not-duckling, not-duck appearance. They give no sign of wanting to go back to their tiny selves and the days when they made squawking sounds. Perhaps it's because they've no mirrors and are unaware of their in-between look. Perhaps it's because growing up with confidence is an act of faith. Faith that they come from good stock and will grow to be waterproof. One duckling stands out because it has a tuft of soft feathers on the top of its head, rather like a fez, a hat that doesn't keep your ears warm or the sun out of your eyes. A fez is a cap that serves no purpose, so far as I can tell. It only makes you look kind of out of place. I wonder, seeing it, why the expression is silly goose instead of silly duck. But so far, I've given you only description and no story. The fun of pets is not in describing them, but in telling their tales. This is a story that starts out sad, with a genuine sadness of real facts. No tricks here, no discovery that the sadness was a mistake or misunderstanding or that things weren't really as I described them. I tell you this up front, as a warning. As a warning, but also as a promise. A promise that from sadness, a good story can come. There are some things that can only happen in circumstances that we would not want to be created. Things that otherwise would have no reason to transpire. That is what makes a good story. So if you want to avoid feeling a little sadness, stop listening now. But if you stop here, another warning. If you don't pass through the difficult parts, you will never experience the ending. An ending that has the same kind of happiness as a life touched with hope. As we learn that things are not as bad as we might have thought, not as bad as they might have been, and that good things can transform the bad. Still, I haven't gotten around to actually telling the story. I think of this part as a prologue, the first part of a book that most people skip and safely can, and is nothing more than the author talking but not telling any story at all. You, of course, have been tricked into listening to the prologue because only now have I told you that it was an unnecessary part. This is perhaps a nasty trick. It's done now, so there's really no use in complaining about it at this point. You know the background and the setting where the story takes place. This is on the little plot of land in Kansas in the springtime. A plot of land that has in one corner a pond with a rolling green prairie and trees on one shore. The pond is a few minutes' walk from the house that sits on the same plot of land. And the characters in our story, you know them too. There are two sets. There is the group of ducklings that lives in the hutch up near the house, surrounded by a short fence that marks the boundaries of their world. Six of them there are, as you recall, three white, actually yellowed with dirt, and three brown, one with that tuft of feathers that it wears like a fez. The other characters are a set of four adult ducks. These are the ones that came with the hutch and immediately made a break for it when we brought them here. They laid claim to the pond as their home, having escaped the confines of captivity, and found, they think, their true calling. They are irrepressible. They refuse to be captured and kept behind a fence again. The other characters are more minor. There's me, of course, your narrator. My role is pretty small. I do feed pieces of bread to the pond ducks when I visit them every day. I also try to capture them again, but they turn out to be much faster than my canoe and easily outmaneuver me. They probably don't intend to tease me, but I feel a little teased as they grab bread from my hand or even jump for it as I hold it higher than they can reach. But yet as I try to grab one of them, it's gone as soon as I can thrust out my hand. I think that I can feel a feather when I'm at my fastest and they are at their slowest. The other minor character, I don't know what to call it. It's probably not a good practice to tell stories with a character with no name and no description. I will try not to make that a practice, but since this is a true story, the character must remain as unidentified as it is in real life. I've never seen it. I've never heard it make a sound, never smelled, and never had it brush against me. But I have felt it. I have felt it in the same way you feel when walking in the dark, that you should move faster and toward some place secure and lit. I have felt it in the way you feel the person on the other end of a telephone that is silent when you say, "Hello?" I have felt this other minor character, and what is important here is that I have seen its effects. Our four pond ducks lived happily on the prairie side of the pond when they were not swimming, which is really much of the time, and they did everything as though they were a single animal. They glided across the water in a huddle, all at the same speed and turning at the same time. When they came on land, they did it as a group, never with one staying behind, never with one wandering off. When they saw me approaching, they all started quacking together, and they all waddled as a single group to beg for bits of bread. They'd grown up in captivity and had always been fed food. While the pond holds a bounty of things ducks can eat, grass, bugs, snails, broadleaf plants, they'd never eaten any of those things and didn't understand them to be food. And so it fell to me, the narrator of the story, to bring them food in a form they recognized, because even though they were surrounded by nutrition, they would have starved without me throwing it to them. Every day, often twice, I went to the pond to feed the four ducks. But one morning I fed only three. The ducks, never separated, were now three-quarters of their former selves. One was simply gone. There was no trace. Perhaps I should hold out hope for you that the missing duck's lust for freedom had led it to develop an independent streak, and that it took off traveling to find its way in life to something still better than a farm pond on a Kansas prairie. Perhaps I should hold out hope that it might have gotten lost and stuck underneath the underbrush from which it needed freeing, or that it was me and I had miscounted. Perhaps I should, but this is a true story, and it has the true sadness that the next morning there were only two. Two ducks and a pile of brown feathers. It is highly doubtful that one duck found freedom, and the next was found by our unnamed, unseen minor character that is felt from its effects. It is much more likely that both of them succumb to the same fate, but that the second left more trace evidence of the crime behind. When there are only two left, it quickly became clear that ducks are smart. They gave up their nighttime home along the open prairie shore and nestled down in a mass of broken branches on the water's edge at the pond's berm. Their thorn-ridden hiding place could not be approached quietly. The only real access was from the water. These two survivors, a male and a female, became skittish, and they stopped greeting me and coming for bread. They waited until after I left before they came and ate the bread that I'd thrown on the ground. As evening came, they became quiet, their quacking stopping. They have learned to be careful and to be guarded. They were two but one in the same sense that they had been four but one, moving everywhere together in unison. And this is me, your narrator, applying human features to animals, anthropomorphizing or personifying. But once committed to each other's survival, they seemed happy enough to live such a careful and rough life as long as they were together. This went on for several days, and they seemed to have a new rhythm. A new rhythm until there was one, the female, quacking loudly as I came into sight, quieting as I approached. 100 feet away, but quacking loudly again as I walked away. Our unnamed character had made its presence felt again. I quacked as I returned to the house and stopped about every 5 feet. Staying back, she moved as I did until I turned the corner and down the hill and was out of sight. She quacked for me, but came no closer. I went on returning to the house to refill the water can that supplies the ducklings in the pen. That took me 10 minutes or so, refilling the water, changing the bedding, giving them food. The sun was set, but it was still light. Then I heard a loud quacking. Down the hill came the surviving adult, her loneliness overcoming her fear, of waddling someplace new, alone, as the night fell. I opened the side of the duckling's pen and herded her in, shutting the fence behind and opening the door to the hutch. As she went in, there was much quacking, and introductions were made, and stories were told of the dangers of the outside world. Or perhaps it was merely a discussion of the house rules and where one could get a bite of food and a drink of water. The next morning I opened the door to the hutch. In the first flickers of the morning lights, the adult had pushed her way under the fence and led the ducklings through the hole. We put the ducklings back and fixed the fence, but the one adult returned to the pond and to her freedom. In the evening I walked to the pond, as was my regular routine, and seeing me, she quacked her loudest quack and waddled alongside as I returned to the house. Once there, I opened the fence, and she went into the hutch with the ducklings to spend the night. Then, when morning came, I opened the hutch again. This time, though, I picked her up and put her outside the fence so she could have the liberty without leading the ducklings into the pond where they were not yet old enough to swim. She stood outside, looking in. As I left, she paced back and forth, quacking to get back in the fence. By that evening, she was back at the pond, and I had events keeping me away until twilight. As I watered the ducklings, the adult came, on her own, back from the pond, standing at the fence, waiting to be let in. The next morning was much the same, me putting her out, her pacing outside, quacking some conversation across the fence. This time, however, she was not content to spend her day swimming. Instead, she went under the fence, but this time the other way, to rejoin the ducklings, having found that freedom is not so simple as being free from a hutch or a fence, and having found that her happiness did not reside in wilderness, but in relationships formed in fences that protect from those unnamed characters that wander in the wilderness and leave trace evidence of their crimes.